you think about power in your workplace? Power is such an abstract concept that it's hard to put your finger on. But we all know when power is empowering or disenfranchising. And when the power dynamics aren't designed to empower, everyone loses. This week, I talk with Dr. Tanji Reed Marshall, an educator and consultant who has done fascinating work on power. Here we chat about the importance of mindfully building or rebuilding your power structure to foster greater equity and empowerment, and in return, improve results and boost your bottom line. Thank you so much, as always, for listening.
Welcome to the Imposter Syndrome Files. My name is Kim Menninger, and as an executive coach and former high-tech leader, my personal mission is to help professionals overcome imposter syndrome so that you can advance your career with confidence. Each week, I interview a new guest who brings a powerful perspective to this conversation, including personal stories, best practices, and new insights. The more we talk about this issue, the more we destigmatize imposter syndrome, recognize that we're not alone, and empower ourselves to access the tools and resources that can help us and those around us. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing with others you think would benefit from this conversation.
Welcome, Tanji. I am so excited for our conversation. I've been excited for this conversation since before I invited you to it. When we were having our discussion a few weeks ago and you started talking, I was like, I need to have this person on my podcast because I can't wait to dive into your work. Before we do that, I would love to invite you to introduce yourself. Just tell us a little bit more about you and who you are, what you do.
All right. Well, formally, I am Dr. Tanji Reed Marshall, and casually, I am Tanji Marshall, and my grandson calls me Nan Nan, and my son-in-law calls me Dr. T. So I'm all of those, and I love being that. I'm an educator with over two decades worth of experience at both the classroom level, at the leadership level. I have a doctorate in curriculum and instruction from Virginia Tech, and I came into education as a second career. I was going to be a buyer and fly all over the world and buy fancy clothes and handbags. And I got an epiphany. And it was, if I was going to work that hard, I wanted it to be about something that really was going to last in the world. And the person that my now husband, who was a dear friend of mine, we were sort of dating, and I started and ran a tutoring program in our hometown. And that sparked it for me. And from there, I became a teacher. I got a master's degree in English education. Then I got my doctorate. I now run Liaison Educational Partners, which is an educationally focused, equity-minded educational consultancy. And we do three main things. We work on curriculum, instruction, and culture. And we really help organizations, both at the school side and at the organization side, look at their mission, vision, and values for greater alignment by really examining policies, practices, and the dynamics of power embedded in their relationships and teams. And so we really help people deeply dig into themselves first and then push it out to their teams. And we take a five framework approach to that. We help people learn, then we help them plan. We help them apply the learning and the plans that they have sort of instituted and constructed. Then we help them step back and do some evaluation before we go into full-scale integration. In school language, we call that a cycle of improvement. So we use a cycle of improvement along the way so that people can really, really don't jump to solutions first. Like, we are very good with solutionitis. And I want people to stop for a moment and step back. And I want them to learn, really to get some understanding and analyze some critical aspects of their organization, what might be some key drivers that's sort of blocking and barriers to success. And a lot of times, those barriers to success I have found in my work stem at the people level. You know, a product's a product. And of course, you're going to tweak it, you're going to test it. But a lot of times, those lasting effects are at the people level. And I know this to be true. If you get the dynamics of the power correct and balanced and even, everything else will fall in line. You know, we hear a lot about cultural responsiveness. Well, I take the posture of cultural responsibility, because if you are responding to something, that means you're waiting for a thing to happen and then you react. But if you're responsible, you're proactive. You're already with your mindset going down the road, thinking about how can I make the best environment for my people, right? And that could be your children, your students that you teach. It could be the teachers you lead. It could be your sales team, right? It could be anybody within a team that you're leading. And so, and we look at four main environments that are created when this idea of power is examined. And the first one is the one everyone wants. It's this one about being empowered, right? That is the, I call that one the hashtag goals. We're all leading to get there, right? The next one right below that, so it's four quadrants. The next one are dimensions. Dimension two is what I call agentic, right? The agentic ones, you're developing your agency. And the critical difference between agency and empowerment is you have to exercise agency in a particular way to live out being empowered. Because empowerment means you fully understand that you've got agency, how to marshal it for yourself, and then you move forward in your actions, but you're thinking first, so that you make the decisions that are best in your own interest. Right. And then right after that is the power protecting. It's the one that is probably the most challenging to detect. At the school level side, it would be hard to detect because it would be in an environment that looks like it's really working well. Mm. On the industry side, that's going to be in a team or a department that on the surface, everyone is what I call kikiing and guffawing at the water fountain. But when you kick the tires and look under the hood, you have some serious relational challenges. But what makes it hard is in that protective environment, they are getting results. You know, that teacher, that building leader, that regional president, that team leader, they might be hitting their numbers, but you might want to think about what's the cycle of turnover? What's happening in the building? What's happening on the team? Are people wanting to stay or do they go at the earliest sign that they can leave? And then the other one, the worst one, is disenfranchising. And I think of it this way. We both have been in school. I want to take you back to your BC days. we could pick our courses, right? But every now and then we picked a course, and our very stomach would churn the minute we thought about having to step into that classroom. There was something about the culture, something about the professor that really created a hostile learning environment. That's disenfranchising. Those hostile environments exist everywhere on the school side, but they are evident on the industry side as well. And so those are the lenses that I really help people understand deeply and then work through how to detect where they might be. And then we work through a plan of let's do a problem of practice protocol on something. Let's think about how we can deeply examine one lever of change. And then let's do some planning around it. Let's apply some critical principles or strategies. Let's step back and look at it and see what's happening. And then let's go forward and do some implementation and full integration of what we learned to make lasting change.
I am so fascinated by this because the concept of power seems so ambiguous. And like the way that you have broken it down in a, you know, It just feels so much more actionable. And I'm curious, when you talk to people, you mentioned the, you know, power protecting place. I can imagine that everybody, well, most people want to be at the empowering level, maybe even think they are, right? But how much resistance do you encounter when people have to own the fact that they're not there, right? Like, what? How do you get them to a place of awareness where they can even realize like, oh, we have a problem here?
Yeah. Number one, one of the things I've developed, and I'm really excited because it's going through a testing phase, is I actually have a power questionnaire.
Ah.
And so, you know, people say this all the time. People lie, data doesn't. Right? Like data doesn't lie. You know what I mean? And so really helping people tap into some critical areas. And so when I think about the power, think about power as an acronym, right? So the P stands for your position, right? Where are you, your role and your responsibilities? What is that? And then O is your ownership. How are you owning that position that you've got? Are you making space for others? Are you holding on to it very tightly? And then W is for the work. Do you know what your work is? How do you help others come with you on the work cycle? And then the E is for the wholesale environment itself. And then R is for the relationships. So we ask a series of questions, you know, meant to get at each of those five. So you can really begin, and it's not an exact science because nothing actually is when it's qualitative and you know this, but it really gives you some insight. Am I a position holder in a way that negatively impacts the environment writ large and the relationships specifically? You know, am I holding on to the work? Am I owning my space but not allowing others to own theirs or come into mine? Right. And so when we have those conversations, and then we look at some bottom lines, like let me see your numbers. You know, if this is at the school level, I want to see your discipline numbers. I want to see your referral numbers. I want to see the teachers who might be having high absentee rates. On the industry side, I want to look at your employee satisfaction results. I want to look at that, right? I want to look at your attendance, right? I want to watch you on Zoom and see who comes off camera and who doesn't come off camera.
Mm.
Like, I want to watch those things and be your guide on the side to help you see, oh, this could be an area of opportunity for you to ask some deeper level questions, particularly for new managers and middle managers who are trying to sort of level up and don't know really, you know, how to navigate that. But new managers find this particularly important for them.
That's a really critical time to get them too, right? Because they haven't had time to sort of build some bad habits. And it, in a sense, it's more, you know, they're sort of aspiring towards that as opposed to being told that they're doing something wrong already, right? Because I would imagine that there's less defensiveness when they're just starting out than when they're already in the role and now being told, hey, you're going to have to make some changes.
Some changes. That's right. You know what I mean? And one of the things I ask people to do is I want people to tap into their power orientations. Like, how did you learn about it? And the first place we learn about power and authority is where? At home. I learned about power and authority very early. It was never a question who was in charge of my house. Ever. Never. And to this day, if I walk into my mom's house, I'm already taken back to who was in charge, right? And, you know, I tell this story. My mom was an MC. She was a fabulous MC. She just had this way of bringing an audience with her. And my sister and I were sitting on the front row and we are just, you know, kicking around. We're just rustling paper. I think my mom gave us a 12-second eyeball. And listen, let me tell you, we had to straighten up and fly right. You know what I'm saying? But that's where we learn it, right? And when I became a teacher, I took that with me, right? Now, I have a grandson who is not growing up the same way. He's learning about power and authority very early in a different way than I did and even his mom did, right? Because his mom lived in a straight up and fly right house, right? That's where his mama lived. But he's growing up in a house where he has a whole lot more agency, a whole lot more decision-making space. Right. And so that when he goes out into the world, it's not going to be anything for him to self-advocate. You know what I mean? He was getting ready. This is a fun story. He was going to pre-K and he had to meet his new pre-K teacher. And he was, they're explaining to my daughter about lunch. You know, you go to school, they have the whole lunchroom. And so rite of passage, like school lunch is a rite of passage. You know what I mean? And the teacher says to my daughter, hey, if he is a picky eater, you can bring his food. He was in earshot of that teacher. And immediately he said, I am not a picky eater and do not call me that.
Oh,
at 4 years old.
Oh.
That's a very different way of understanding your power as a child relative to an adult.
Absolutely.
So when we have these managers that are new managers or middle managers, they have a power orientation that they learn. Mm. And they need to be able to name that. And they need to be able to, I call it a memory lane. They need to walk down memory lane and go grab it. Because as I tell people, who you are comes with you everywhere you go. You like, don't leave it in the car. It's not in the trunk. It's with you in your hip pocket. So, you know, and there's a really famous saying that is attributed to Anais Nin, but it's not her saying. It just gets attributed to her. And the saying is, we see things as we are, not as they are.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So we don't see things as the things are. We see them as who we are. Again, because who you are is with you when you walk through any door you go through. And so, you know, tapping into that dynamic is game changing, right? Because if you tap into that and you get that alignment right, your inclusivity through the roof, because you'll be mindful. Right?
Yeah.
Your ability to appreciate the perspectives of others through the roof, the stability on your teams through the roof, right? The respect level of humanity through the roof. And ultimately your bottom line is not even a question anymore, because you can begin to work on developing skills that might be needed, the hard skills, right? Oh, we want the soft skills. Well, this is a critical soft skill. It's a critical soft skill that directs all the other soft skills.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's so interesting because when you gave that example of your grandson, I started thinking about how even in today's workplaces where there's so many different generations, right, there's so many misperceptions and conflicts because people who come from an older generation call the newer generation entitled and think that they're sort of overstepping in certain kinds of situations. And I just think it's so important what you said of this is so much a function of our own experience and our own sort of expectations and relationship to power. And I'm assuming that the trend is going to continue over time, that people are going to have a lot more comfort with self-advocacy and being
part of
that decision-making process. So it's partly, as you said before, you have to learn about yourself first and then really think about how do I, knowing that this is the landscape that I'm operating within, right? How do I need to adjust to that?
That's right. Yeah. And on the power of protecting side, people protect themselves, right? Themselves and their orientations and who they are as people and individuals. They protect their position, right? But then they protect institutions.
Mm.
They protect the culture of the institution itself. And so, and this is particularly salient on the school side. Like school education is an institution. And there are just some mechanisms that are in place that people are hardwired to protect, right? There are some cultural dynamics in place that people just can't name in an organization, but they will protect it. Right. It's the unspoken culture that gets protected the most. Right. It's like, well, we just don't do that thing. Like we just don't do that. And nobody can hearken back to the day when you didn't do like when you did it. Like no one can find the whole, like it's not written down. Right. It's called the hidden curriculum of culture. right? That there's there are people who are, you know, drivers of that. You know, we talk about, you know, intellectual capacity, and we talk about, you know, there's going to be, what it's called, like holding on to, they hold on to a thing that is institutionally ascribed, but no one can find out where it is. But we all kind of live by it. We just kind of know it's there, right? So like at the organization where I used to work, there was an unspoken rule that every meeting kind of started like 5-ish minutes late. Mm-hmm. And so when I first got there, I came out of school. You can't be late at school. Because if you're late, Johnny's in the hallway, and that's a problem. Johnny can't be in the hallway, right? So I go into this culture, and I'm dressed up, and I got my whole suit on, the whole nine. No one's wearing a suit. But it's not written down that we are casual. It's just kind of like you pick it up, right?
Yeah.
And then the whole meeting thing was always we're going to all kind of gather. But then you have a person like me who steps into that. And I'm like, well, Johnny's in the hallway. I can't be late, you know, sort of really understanding the hidden curriculum of culture is critical. But that's a power dynamic, because when a person feels a certain level of institutional, personal, or positional threat, they will lean in and protect. And they do it in very subtle ways that unless you know what the telltale signs are, you'll miss it. Yeah. You'll miss it, but you'll feel it. Like you'll feel it, but you won't know how to name it. And so having this power framework gives names. It gives names. It gives a framework. It gives an orientation to it that really can break down some silos and really open up environments. So people want to have a great environment. Like no one creates a company to have a terrible work environment. No one's doing that. Like I haven't met anybody who woke up and said, you know what, this is the day I want to have a bad work environment for the people that I lead. No one does that. You know what I mean? And so my role is to really help them lean in on a very deep level of culture that they may not have considered, and really help them see more broadly and more deeply. So that they can do the things that they want to do. They can be a great company. They can have wonderfully high performing teams where everybody knows that they belong, right? And that they are valued and respected and can be a productive member of a team for sure.
So when you say that, I mean, I feel like that's the thing that we all want. Like you said, nobody wants to architect a system that's going to make people miserable and it's going to, right? Like, but I think about as you're talking, there's a spectrum, even just in terms of the dimensions that you define, but also like the inner work that's required for this. And when you talk about power protectors, right, that vulnerability required to recognize I'm getting in the way of what I actually want, or that I may have to lose something, or that fear that comes with change, right? Like, is it necessary to be at a certain place already in order to do this work? Or can you really start anywhere?
I feel like it takes willingness. You know what I mean? I wrote a book, and it was ed focused, but the more I talk to people, the more it crosses industry and profession. And I lay out very clearly about who I was. I was a power protecting person as a new educator. You know, I had my power orientation. I had come into teaching from retail, which is, you know, high speed, high demand. You walk fast. You wear black every day. You know, I literally wore black every day. Teaching third graders, I wore black every day. Yeah. Okay. And like, you know, you have to like walk your kids down the hall. So I want you to imagine a mother duckling who's walking down the hall and a string of little ducklings behind them. That was me. And I am walking at like top New York speed and these little kids can't keep up. And I'm like, look, we got to get somewhere. We got to go to gym. I'm like, it's gym. Relax. But I really had to. It takes a catalyzing event, I would say. I will say that. So you might be a disenfranchiser and not realize it. You might be a power protector. You might be anywhere, but there has to be a catalyzing event that is so impactful that it creates the need to pause, and you are left with no other choice but to ask yourself a different set of questions. That's the game plan. You've got to be able to be willing to ask yourself a different set of questions when that catalyzing event happens. It could be with a person. It could be with a person that you lead. It could be with a peer. It could be that your sales numbers have hit rock bottom and you just can't figure out why. Mm-hmm. It could be any number of catalyzing events, but it is a catalyzing event that kicks it off.
That makes perfect sense, because inertia is so powerful, right? And there's nobody's going to put themselves through the discomfort of change unless there's something more compelling on the other side of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe you got a really tough 360 eval, mm-hmm. right? Maybe your disc components are just so out of whack and uneven, right? Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of things that could really create this space for a person to want to ask some different questions about themselves first, and then to the team, and then out to the organization and things like that, for sure.
So you just made me think of something too when you said asking yourself first. Is this work that has to be done at the entire system level, or can it be done in smaller pieces?
Pieces. There's no organization ready to do it on a full scale.
Mm.
Because systemically, right? So forget systematic approaches to something. Systemically, organizations are not set up to do that, right? The better thing is to take the willing, right? Mm-hmm. To take the willing, and then they become a catalyst to spread out from there. You're like, oh my God, you know, we did this thing, this happened. We learned about our power. We did this. Look at how it's impacting us. Our relationship is this. We were able to do this. We have better, more open communication, right? As a leader, I am more willing to ask for help from people who work for me and my peers. I foster innovation. You know, I look for innovation. I am trying to get people to really, you know, teamwork, collaborate, authentically collaborate. You know what I mean? Bring their ideas. I'm open to all of that. You know what I mean? And so mm-hmm. I think it's something of this nature is always better small.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right too. And I'm thinking about it even in terms of like, adoption of new technology or something, where you always get your early adopters, your really enthusiastic people who are at the forefront, and then you've got your laggards and your skeptics, and right. So I love what you're saying about getting those first people who are really on board to then demonstrate the value of making these changes, and then you start to change the minds of the other people who are a little bit further behind.
Absolutely, yeah,
yeah.
That's how it works. It's a fascinating body of work. I just look forward to partnering with lots of folks who really talk about it. You know, and I'm glad that we're talking about it, because the more people hear about it, the more they're like, yeah, that makes so sense. And here's the thing. The minute somebody hears about the concept of power protecting, they can name 10 people off the top of their head, themselves included, without blinking an eye. You're like, oh, yeah, that's it.
So true. It's such a good point. And that's what I was thinking about earlier when I was talking about how you have taken this concept and broken it down, because you think power and you get overwhelmed by it. Where do you start? Right. And I think that just having a framework to, you know, sort of help people. What are the behaviors? How do I know where I fall?
And that's exactly what I do. We talk about dispositions. We talk about environment. And we talk about actions, right? So when you are in a power protecting environment, what's the disposition of the leader of that environment, right? Mm-hmm. How do you know it when you see it? Like, what's the behavior? Like, what's happened? What's the environment feel like? What does it look like, feel like, right? In schools, we do a lot of like walkthroughs We use things called walkthroughs where we look at instruction and we watch. It's the same principle, right? Mm-hmm. You go and you watch and you just sit and you're watching. And you look at meetings, you look at the Zoom screen. You know, there are ways to really tie that together so that a person who's leading can begin to learn, hey, you know, I noticed this over here. I noticed a lot of unevenness over here. And then to top it all off, we talk about the use of six different types of power, like types of power. So I've got my four dimension, but then I couple them with six types of power. So we talk about reverent power, right? You, like you and I, you know, we have Boston College in common. That's a reverent power that we are now equalized on, mm-hmm. right? We have something immediately in common. We don't have to like, oh, Harvard, BC, like we're not doing any of that nonsense, right? Because we went to the best university in the world. But anyway, you know, we talk about that. We talk about reward power. You know, how does a leader use reward to manage behavior? And you have to do all of them, right? Like the reverent one is around relationships and commonality. But sometimes if you lean too hard, you're going to create imbalance someplace else.
Yeah.
Right. If you lean into reward too heavily, then you create people who are not intrinsically motivated. Right. And so they only deal with carrots. You know, then we talk about coercive power.
Mm.
Well, sometimes you just got to get in there and do that.
True,
right. Yeah. Like, you just got to get in there and do it. But if that is your modus operandi, you create that disenfranchisement. And then we go on to talk about others. And so, you know, we really want people to understand what they're doing with their behavior and why. Why are you doing this? You know, and what's the effect on other people and your bottom line, right? Like we got to get clear. This is about your bottom line. You know, in schools, the bottom line is, you know, student outcomes need to be improved for reading and math across all grade levels, you know, reduced absenteeism, you know what I mean? Like higher motivation. On the org side, it is bottom line sales. You got to sell stuff. You know, I'm a former retailer. We had to sell gloves, period, full stop. You know what I mean? That's it. How many gloves did you sell and what color and what size?
Yeah.
So, you know, so at the bottom line, it's about the numbers, but the numbers only tell you one part of the story. You know what I mean? You've got to, you know, as a researcher, you've got to lean into a mixed method approach that takes into account the quantitative data for outcome understanding and then the qualitative data for understanding correlation and cause.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about this a lot too, is that I have an undergraduate degree in psychology, right? So, as do you. So we know this stuff because it's interesting to us and we learned it. And, but you think about how many people in the business world today who never studied any of this, it's not intuitive to them in the way that it is to us. And so a lot of what you're describing is enlightenment in a way that, you know, there's always resistance to change, but if you don't know, it's almost, you know, in and of itself, when you talk about power, another form of unconscious bias, right? Because if you don't know that your power style or your approach to power is driven by your own experience and that it differs from somebody else's, right? Like you may be banging your head against the wall, wondering why you can't get your team on board. You can't get the results you're looking for, but you That's have right. no idea what to do
no
differently.
Idea. You'd have no idea. You have no idea. And so this really helps people get an idea, mm-hmm. right? Like get an idea and like, oh, we got to do, you know, we got to do DEI and we got to be this. Yeah, you do have to be that. But you've got to also be it in an authentic way that is not undermining the humanity of another person.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like you've got to be clear about what it is you're doing and how that's working, you know, on that side with your teams, you know, with your teams. And, you know, maybe you're on the HR team. Maybe you're on the development side of a business. Maybe you are on the sales side of a business. right? Maybe you're on the product development side of a business and you just cannot get the team working together the way that it should because somebody is holding on to a thing that they don't realize.
Yes.
And I'm here to release you. Let it go.
Let it go. Which is just so important because I just think that, you know, a lot of times if you're super results oriented, you think that the people side is, oh, that's fluffy, right? Like that's a waste of time. We don't worry about that stuff. But this is just reinforcing the idea that you have to look at the intersection between people and results in order to get to where you want to be.
Because people are the conveyor to the results. You know, it's like when you go to the airport, you get your luggage on the conveyor belt. Humans are the conveyor belt of your results.
Exactly.
Period. So true.
And I know there's no precise answer to this question, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on if there are people who are thinking, this sounds amazing and I'm busy and I've got a million things going on in my life. Like, I don't know that I can make the time commitment. Like, what do you think about when you think of how this fits into all the other responsibilities and demands of our time? Like, I'm sure you're going to say yes to this, but I'm just curious, like how you handle an objection from somebody who says, we don't have time for that. Right. Are there ways of making it sustainable? Are there ways of making it doable, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, my response to it is, well, you certainly don't have to make time, but are you happy with your results? So fine. Don't make the time. You're right. You're 100% correct. Do not make the time. And then call me in 6 months because your results are going to be worse than they are now because you would not have taken the time to this is an investment in your people, right? Mm-hmm. Do you want better results? Do you want to stop the leaky bucket of people leaving? Because that's its own investment cycle, right? Because every time you have a person who comes on board, you have to spend money to train them, right? You give them 90 days or whatever. And if you don't catch it within the first 90 days, then you're on the hook.
That's right.
You're on the hook. And then, okay, fine. And then what? And then what? You know what I mean? So yeah, you're right. You don't have the time. And then I can't wait till you call me in 6 months.
That's a perfect answer because you're absolutely right. That is often my response to people who say, I don't have time. It's like, you don't have time not to do this, right? Because you're gonna be spending time on something. And if what you're spending your time on is not working, keep doing it. But
then my question would be right then, what are you power protecting right now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right now in your resistance is its own form of power protecting. What engines of this institution are you protecting right now? Right? Mm-hmm. What part of yourself are you protecting right now that you do not want to invest in other people who don't want to protect? And because you now hold the purse strings to it, you are the barrier to somebody else's advancement. But okay, go ahead. Go ahead. I love that for you. I love that for you. Great. It's wonderful.
I love that so much. So I'm thinking about this in terms of, you know, this is your work that you have been focused on. And like, so for people who are riveted and want more of what we're talking about, what's the first step? Do they reach out to you? Like where do we go next?
Yeah, where do we go next? You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Dr. Tanji Reed Marshall on LinkedIn. You can email me, liaisoneducationalpartners@gmail.com. You can reach out to my assistant at throughtheireyesconsult@gmail.com and set up a discovery call. I'd love to chat, love to keep going and be a great partner in this work to really get people moving to create the environments they set out to create every day.
And I'll put those links in the show notes as well for anybody who's interested. And I just thank you so much, Tanji, for being here, but also for the work you're doing. It is so important. And I think it's foundational to all of the other things that we claim to want to change and fix, right? And you had talked about it earlier too, of inclusivity just kind of, it is a byproduct of what you're talking about, right? Like, you know, we're trying to solve things at a very superficial level without getting to the root cause. And that's what I love so much about what you're doing. So thank you for your pioneering of this important work. And thank you so for much. Having this conversation with me.
I appreciate it. And just for anyone who's listening, I am the book that kicked all this off is called Understanding Your Instructional Power, Curriculum and Language Decisions to Support Each Student. But I promise you, don't let the title get you hung up that you're going to be learning about school. You might, but the gems in there are crossover effect everywhere you go. We're celebrating a 1-year anniversary. I'd love to be in conversation with folks about it. So, yeah.
Perfect. And I'll make sure that that's linked in the show notes as well. Thank you so much.
Pleasure was all mine, Kim. I can't wait to do it again sometime.
Absolutely.
All right, friend. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Thanks so much for listening to the Imposter Syndrome Files. If you would like to continue this conversation in a safe and trusted space, I would love for you to join my virtual discussion group every Thursday at 12 p.m. Eastern. For the past several years, the group has been limited to women, but it is now open, regardless of gender, to anyone who is interested in exploring and troubleshooting common workplace challenges, building better awareness of ourselves and others, and becoming more inclusive allies at work. Check out the show notes for more info on how to find us. And please join us next week for another episode of the Imposter Syndrome Files.